All right, well, let's get started. One of our panelists is still in the cab. We'll be here any minute, so we put him last in schedule. So, but, all right, so thanks for joining us for our second panel this morning on Exceptional Responder. So, you know, I think the discussion today has a little bit to do with the panel that we had earlier and what's going on in the panel this afternoon when we talk about different development options. And I'd like to give a little bit of an introduction to the discussion here before we hand it off to the panelists. So what is an exceptional responder? I think there are a couple different definitions. Some of them are for inclusion into the exceptional responder initiatives and things like that. But essentially, you know, generally what we say is, you know, it's really an exceptional responder or cancer patients exhibit successful but unanticipated therapeutic benefit from an intervention such as, and it could be chemotherapy, radiotherapy, surgery, targeted agent, or something like that. And numerous case reports have been reported, throughout the decades, really. And, initially without any explanation, they've been considered Lazarus effects. You know, nobody really knew why they had such a exceptional response. And you know, in some of these cases, they've equated to cures. So there's many anecdotal case reports, and many of them may not ever be repeated because nobody knows the exact situation that led to the exceptional response. So, you know, the key is, you know, how do we capture all this information and put it into, a framework that we can identify exceptional responses and learn from them so we can make them broadly accessible or find a different way to deliver therapeutics to patients that are most likely to benefit from it. So, in these clinical trials where exceptional responses are seen, you know, they are, usually in failed trials. So there's a lot of effort to look at how do you resurrect old drugs, but think about how do you reposition it for those patients that, you know, had those sort of exceptional responses. So what I did is quickly just look through. I was originally going to go through abstracts and pull out different abstracts on case history of exceptional responses, but luckily I found something on the website you guys probably know about. It was a competition for physicians and researchers to submit profiles of exceptional responders to compete for. I think it was a $3,000 reward for the best case. And, they had about 60 or so cases that were profiled on the website. And, you know, what's really interesting when you read through them, they go across all malignancies. You know, here's someone, some heme malignancies, CNS tumors. But also the interventions, you know, sometimes they're just surgery. Sometimes they, you know, exceptional response from just surgery that they didn't expect somebody to be cured from, you know, this particular approach. It could be radiotherapy. It could be, you know, old cytotoxic chemotherapy, or it could be a particular pathway inhibitor. And, nobody really knows in many of these cases why they had a really exceptional response, but it's just these are documented cases out there. And when you go through, you know, again, I just, you know, easily pulled down all these cases from this competition, but, you know, it goes across all tumor types, heme, solid tumors, hormonal therapies, radiotherapy, targeted agents, and the cases just go on and on. But as yet, there are not many initiatives to pull all these cases together and learn from the exceptional responder. So we're going to hear today, a few of these examples and some of the initiatives now that have been driven, based on this. And what sort of approaches are needed? You know, is it something that it's a, you know, systematic institutional approach, or is it something that's crowdsourced you know, like that case competition, you know, all of a sudden these exceptional cases come out from the woodwork, and you know, patients and physicians want to tell their story. So how do we get all that together and really understand the biology behind it? So we're going to hear a little bit about the Exceptional Responder Initiative, what's going on with some of the basket trials, and some other sort of more network approaches to be able to kind of pull everything that's out there together. And a little bit, you know, how it ties back to the moonshot presentation that we had yesterday and some of the precision medicine initiatives. So that said, I'd like to. And our panelist has arrived. So great, we have a full panel now. So why don't we start? So I think we'll start with David Solid. Talk a little bit about what he's doing. Thank you.
Okay. So thanks for the invitation. I think I coined this term exceptional response, but I didn't know about the $30,000 prize. I could have used that $30,000, so I feel bad. So I'm just going to only give one of those examples very quickly, because really I want to talk about how we've tried to follow up, you know, those type of stories and what we're doing in the clinic right now to really profile every single patient so that nobody's an extraordinary responder. We know why they responded as soon as it happened. So I run what's called the Kravis Center for Molecular Oncology at Memorial. Our goal is pretty simple. Our goal is to, for every single patient who comes to Sloan Kettering, to understand why that patient got cancer and what's making their tumor grow. So very simple goal. We haven't necessarily accomplished it at this point, but what we want to do is define the molecular driver in every single patient, not just some of them, but every single one. We use an assay that looks both at the tumor as well as the normal DNA, so this gives us the unique opportunity to identify germline variants that contributed to why that patient got cancer in the first place. And I only had about 10, 15 minutes, so I'm not really going to talk about that, but I would just say that that effort has been an eye-opener and extraordinarily interesting. So dramatically more patients, or a much significantly higher percentage of patients, have germline mutations than we really anticipated in many different cancer types. Just giving you one example, in prostate cancer, 20% of the patients who we have with recurrent prostate cancer have a pathogenic germline alteration that contributed to why they got the cancer. So as much as these cancers seem random, they're much more predetermined than we thought. And the reason we're doing at least number one here is to facilitate enrollment onto clinical trials, and I'll show at least two slides about that. So here's one of the extraordinary responders published by Gopa Iyer in my lab. This is a patient with ovarian cancer. This is the low-grade serous ovarian type that makes up about 10% of ovarian cancers. And with patients with recurrent low-grade serous ovarian cancer, there's no systemic treatment. So these patients get surgery. Eventually, they get multiple surgeries, develop recurrent disease in their peritoneum, eventually develop bowel obstruction, and no systemic treatments help. And this woman here had three prior surgeries, three systemic agents, none of which had shown any activity in her. And then for no particular reason other than it was an available clinical trial at the institution, she went on this gynecologic oncology group trial, 239, and was treated with a drug called selumetinib, which still has not been FDA approved. This is a MEK inhibitor. You know, it's a pretty decent MEK inhibitor. We have one FDA approved, trametinib, but initially from GSK and now Novartis. And she went on the drug in September of 2009. Within a year, she had achieved a complete response, and she's still on the drug 7.5 years later. She's not off the drug. She takes this MEK inhibitor every day. Occasionally, she'll ask the doctors at Memorial, can I stop taking this drug, because it does have some side effects. And we're too nervous to stop it because we think if we stop it, cancer come back, maybe develop some resistant clones, and we can't get it back into remission. If you actually look at the clinical trial paper from GOG 239 and look at the discussion, it says molecular profiling was unhelpful in figuring out why some patients responded and others did not. And if you just go back to the technology we had at the time, it was not very good. They could look at a few hotspot mutations, and they looked at hotspot mutations in BRAF and KRAS, and they didn't find anything, and so that was their conclusion. So we were able to get a hold of this tumor, and the woman turns out to have a very interesting deletion, a 15 base pair deletion in a gene called MAP2K1. And you say, well, what's MAP2K1? And MAP2K1 is the gene that encodes MEK1, and MEK1's the direct target of this drug. So this doesn't have to be rocket science. This woman has an uncharacterized, unknown reason to respond, but it's not that complicated. She had a mutation in the target of the drug we were using. We just didn't have the capability of testing for it back in 2009, but we really could do that at this point. So what does this deletion do? This deletion is an in-frame alteration, leads to a 5-amino acid deletion in this negative regulatory helix of MEK1, which usually folds over on the protein and inhibits it. But when you get this deletion, you lock that protein into an active conformation. And if you go ahead and make this mutant protein in the lab and put it into a cell, it's incredibly activating. So again, in retrospect, not a shock. A woman with an activating MEK1 mutation has now had a 7.5-year response to a MEK inhibitor on a clinical trial that was otherwise disappointing. But maybe if we could find other patients with similar MEK1 mutations, maybe we wouldn't randomly give this drug. Maybe we would give this drug to patients who have that alteration. And I would say, even though this has now been published almost 2 years in JCO, we still don't have clinical trials for these patients. We've been unable to get a basket study open for patients with MEK1 mutant tumors. We've been able to get some patients this drug off of protocol and have seen some dramatic responses. But I would say most of the patients we have when we find this mutation, still we've had difficulty matching them up with a drug. And, you know, the MEK inhibitor is about $10,000 a month. So unless you can provide access to the drug, you know, finding the mutation is not always really that helpful. So how are we at least looking for the mutations? That, I think, is actually the easier part. At Sloan Kettering, we use an assay called MSK Impact. We take tumor tissue, we take normal cells from the blood, we extract DNA. We want to be able to then look for all the known cancer genes as cheaply as possible. And I would say cost, this is really an engineering problem. How can we, as quickly and cheaply and as efficiently as possible, find all the known cancer genes and whether they're mutated? And so we actually capture parts of the DNA within the genome using these biotinylated baits that pull down the parts of the genome we care about. We then sequence those parts using a HiSeq and then informatically match that up to the genome. I think what's unique about our program is that we try to offer this to anyone who walks in the door at Sloan Kettering with metastatic disease, whether they can pay for it or not, whether their insurance covers it or not. We will do it for free if it's not paid for by insurance. And then we make all of that data available to everyone at the institution in real time. So whether you're Craig Thompson, our president and CEO, or you just started in the cafeteria, it really doesn't matter. If you have a MSKCC email address, you can log in and look at this in real time. And you probably can't see it here, and this slide's a little bit old, but we've now sequenced over 16,000 patients over the last couple of years using this assay. And we've started to make the data publicly available broadly beyond Sloan Kettering through an initiative called AACR Genie. So if you go to the portal or search AACR Genie, there's a link that will at least get you access to that data beyond Sloan Kettering. So the goal of this was really to accelerate enrollment onto clinical trials, and there's really been this huge uptick in patients enrolling onto clinical trials. And really what it's led to is that we, for these basket studies, that we've really pushed very hard as a very efficient way to sort of test that hypothesis. If you've got a mutation in gene X, will you respond to inhibitor of gene X? We really end up enrolling almost all the patients on these studies, and it simply comes down to the fact that our peer institutions don't genetically test for any of these mutations, so they don't find them. So the HER2 basket, which I run with Dave Hyman and Jose Baselga, we've enrolled probably about 65-70% of the patients. I just wanted to highlight this one AKT study as an example where this is just required to do clinical trials, in my mind, at sort of the cutting edge in 2017. So this was a trial that we initially were not part of. This was an AstraZeneca study of an ATP competitive AKT inhibitor. And this study had been open at over a year, at over 20 institutions, and they had only enrolled 7 patients on the study. And I guess the docs were saying, you know, we can't enroll the study. It's impossible. You can't find these patients. Maybe they don't really exist. And we had already found over 100 patients with AKT1, E17K mutations at that time. And then I guess somebody must have said, well, you know, maybe those Sloan Kettering guys, they say they can find these patients. Why don't we ask them to be part of it? We're usually more expensive and kind of a pain in the ass. But eventually we came on to the study, and we put on 6 patients in the first week. This was after 3 months on the study. We had put on about 80% of the patients, and we've now gone on to put on probably about 80% of the total enrollment onto this part of the study. And you say, does it matter? Would it have mattered if this drug had failed due to lack of accrual? And I would argue, yes, it does. And so you could say this is a post-fact extraordinary responder. This is a woman with a ER-positive breast cancer and an AKT-E17K mutation with a metastasis to the conjunctiva. And she was given the AstraZeneca AKT inhibitor, and she went on to have a complete response. So we don't want these drugs to fail simply because we couldn't match up the patient with the right drug. And so my hope going forward is there won't be a need for the extraordinary responder initiative because we know everyone's genetic driver going into the clinical trials, and we can just see did the drug work or did the drug not work in that genomic context. So this is how many patients we've sequenced per month. We started this in 2014. We kind of ramped up, kind of hit our capacity in the spring of 2015, then had to back off a little while, and then started to go up again, but we've kind of peaked out. But even with this number, which we're doing about 600 to 650 a month now, we're still only sequencing about one quarter of the patients who come in the door at Sloan Kettering. So the focus of this has really been on those patients who develop recurrent metastatic disease, but what about the rest of the group? So just for the second half of this presentation, you know, that'll be my question, which is what's next? And I think there's really two ways to go. One and two are really related. We could just do broader analysis. We could do whole exome, RNA sequencing. We can do proteomics or other things. Unfortunately, at least the proteomics, it's just not ready for prime time. Just really doesn't work in clinical samples. But we could do whole exome or genome. That's just an issue of money. Or we can start expanding the population. We can go to earlier stage patients. And I just want to give you one example with a target called ERCC2 that might be relevant here. So this is a project we call Cancer of Unknown Driver. I try hard to come up with these interesting names. So what's a Cancer of Unknown Driver? Well, a Cancer of Unknown Driver is that we sequenced all the known cancer genes, and we found nothing. So it's unknown. It's unknown what's driving that cancer. So here's a patient with adrenal cortical cancer. We ran MSK Impact. Remember, it's got all the known cancer genes in it, and we found no mutation. So it's a cancer. If you have the pathologist go back and look at the pathology, there's cancer cells there. This wasn't a bad tumor sample that we sequenced. So we reflex this one to whole exome. And if you do whole exome sequencing on this patient has 27 mutations. And most of them look like passenger type of events. But what really jumped out was this mutation at the end, this ZNRF3, because there had just been a Nature Genetics paper published a couple weeks prior showing that in adrenal cortical cancer, same type of patient cancer this patient had, the most commonly mutated gene was a gene called ZNRF3, which nobody knew was a cancer gene. But this is an E3 ubiquitin ligase. One could imagine you could maybe target this, you know, by targeting Wnt signaling. But this was a gene that wasn't in our panel, but we do this iteratively. We will add this to the next version of the panel. And so our panel's already, just in 3 years, gone from 341 genes to 410 to now 468. And one could imagine the next panel will have about 500 genes. And you say, well, why don't you just sequence the whole exome in every patient? Be a lot more money. And actually, with the lower coverage of whole exome, we'd miss more than we find. So it's actually not a very good trade-off. But I would say that whole exome isn't the way to go. We've done about 150 of these cases, and I can probably count on one hand the number of cases that were solved with exome that were not solved by MSK Impact. So it's just a very tiny number. So it's not that we're missing coding mutations in the exome. That really hasn't been what we've been missing. So this case, I think, is a little bit more interesting. This is a melanoma. We ran Impact. We found 11 mutations. All of these seem to be passengers, except for this TERP promoter mutation we know is pathogenic. But it's not sufficient to get a TERP promoter mutation. TERP promoter mutation is not sufficient to get a melanoma. We must be missing something else. And what you don't see in this is a BRAF mutation or an NRAS or a KIT mutation, these known canonical drivers in melanoma. So we did whole exome, and now we found 392 mutations. But again, if you look at them informatically, they all seem to be likely passengers. There's nothing that's jumping out. It doesn't mean there isn't something there, but none of them seem to be important. So we now have a new test that looks in RNA called Archer, and this was developed initially by John Iafredi up at MGH and then spun out to this company. And it's sort of a targeted RNA-seq approach, looking for all the fusions that we would be missing with Impact by looking at the DNA. And by running that assay, it turns out that this patient had an ETV6 NTRK3 fusion, and we actually have a basket study for that fusion from a company called Loxo, and this patient's going on to have a complete response. So again, I think the only reason we found this alteration was the patient was lucky to come to Memorial. We ran impact. We didn't find anything, but we kept looking until we solved the case. And in this case, it's finding a fusion that we had been missing. And I would say overall, there's still a good 10 to 20% of tumors where I look at the results of all the sequencing we've done, and I still don't know what's making that a cancer. There's not enough biologic alterations that are definitive in that tumor that it makes sense to me. Germline actually solves some of them, I would say that, and that's something I just don't have time to talk about today. But maybe there's non-coding alterations leading to overexpression of a protein, maybe a deletion of a microRNA that's regulating some tumor suppressor or oncogene. I don't know, but those are cases that we still have to solve, and that's something that we're working on. So I think we could do more sequencing as next, but also I think we can expand the population. We're really focusing on these later stage patients, and I would say by catching patients that are earlier, maybe we can cure them as opposed to just making them live a little bit longer. And I would use the example of Herceptin, which had fairly modest activity in metastatic patients with breast cancer, but actually reduced the risk of recurrence by 50% when used in the adjuvant setting. And so I'll just give two examples of this. One is an initiative called Make an Impact. And this is, something where this allows us to now sequence any patient in the world that has a cancer that we're interested in doing for free, and the patient doesn't even have to come to Sloan Kettering anymore. And so this was really inspired by some rare cancers like histiocytosis, where we have drugs for those cancers, but those patients are still not getting them in the community. So we said, if you send us the tumor, we'll do it for free. We can consent them on the phone and through the mail. And we've had some incredibly interesting cases through this effort. And we've linked this up with some companies. So as an example, just inspired by my personal story, my daughter actually had an ovarian germ cell tumor as a childhood cancer, and we've sequenced those tumors. And what we find in germ cell tumors is that they have a unique distribution of KIT mutations. And so if you look at GIST tumors, they mostly have KIT mutations in exon 11, and these are sensitive to imatinib. But germ cell tumors mostly have KIT mutations in exon 17, and these are intrinsically resistant to drugs like imatinib and sunitinib. But there's a company called Plexicon that's now developed a drug that specifically inhibits exon 17 KIT mutations, which actually arise sometimes in GIST tumors as the resistant mutation in the setting of a pre-existing exon 11 mutation. But the germ cell patients just have it as their de novo event. And so by using this Make an Impact initiative, if there's a company that has a particular target rare cancer that they're trying to do a proof of principle concept in, we can now maybe offer sequencing to those patients anywhere in the world to try to drive enrollment onto that study. And I'll just give one other example of it. We've worked with Puma Biotechnology with the neratinib basket study in that we've seen early responses, pretty high rate of responses in cervical cancer patients with HER2 mutations. And so we're trying to work with them to try to offer anyone with cervical cancer and metastatic disease free testing to try to enroll faster, drive faster accrual to the neratinib basket study. So just last little anecdote. This was an extreme responder analysis. You could say it's sort of a variation of the extraordinary responder thing. But instead of just being a single patient, it's sort of a group of patients that do, on the extreme of what would be expected. So this was related to patients with bladder cancer, where we oftentimes will give neoadjuvant chemotherapy in patients with locally advanced disease to increase their cure rate. But the problem with neoadjuvant chemotherapy in bladder cancer is it's kind of toxic. The urologists don't like to give it because the patients are kind of old and they don't really believe it's that helpful. And so most of the patients don't get it, and then patients recur and they missed out on that opportunity. So what we did is we got together with Ellie Van Allen and others at the Broad, and we did a extreme outlier analysis. So we took the 5% of the patients who have complete pathogenic responses with chemotherapy, and then we took the 5% of the patients who just blow through the chemotherapy in about 5 minutes, and we said, what's different about those two populations? And if you look at it, there was only one mutation that stood out, set of mutations in a gene called ERCC2. And so ERCC2 is in the nucleotide excision repair pathway. Having mutations in ERCC2 predispose you to be very sensitive, hypersensitive to cisplatin. This is not shocking when you look at it in retrospect. But these patients who were having these dramatic, complete responses to the neoadjuvant chemo could be defined by looking for these ERCC2 mutations. So based upon that result, we're now going to initiate a trial through the Alliance for Clinical Trials in Oncology, where we have patients come in, we have their transurethral resection of their bladder tumor to get the tissue. That's part of standard of care. We then sequence the tumor while they're getting the chemo, and then depending upon whether they have an ERCC2 or other DDR mutation, they're going to be offered a bladder-sparing approach, whereas if they're wild-type, they'll get a radical cystectomy. So this type of treatment is incredibly morbid, but maybe we can reduce the intensity of the treatment for patients with a particular set of mutations that are going to be hypersensitive to this neoadjuvant chemo. And so as someone who is a dad of someone who's had chemo at a young age, maybe we are over-treating some of these kids. My daughter's cancer had a 15% cure rate. If you went back 4 decades ago, it's now over 90%. So they need the chemo, but maybe we can get by with less in certain subpopulations. And maybe we don't need a radical surgery to take out the bladder in every patient, especially those that can have a complete response to the chemotherapy. So just to summarize it up, I would just say that the goal of the molecular profiling is pretty simple, just to define the molecular drivers in every patient. And the assay really doesn't matter. It's just the key is to get there, to get that information as efficiently as possible. And then I had to throw in one last comment about immunotherapy because that is the hot thing. And just to say that personalized immunotherapy may change the paradigm in terms of, at least it's my belief, that there is no benefit to molecular profiling for immunotherapy right now. We find mutation load and other things that sort of correlate, but not enough that I would choose to give the treatment or not, with the one exception being microsatellite unstable tumors in cancers that it doesn't have an FDA approval. And I would say, after 19 years at Sloan Kettering, I finally cured my first patient. I don't consider the extraordinary responders yet cured, but because they're mostly still on the drug. But, a patient with prostate cancer, young 50s, MSI tumor, actually germline mutation in a Lynch-related gene, who had failed all the standard treatments, abiraterone, enzalutamide, others, who is now NED almost a year out with a PSA of 0 coming off the hormones after getting immunotherapy. And we find MSI in 1.5% of the patients that we sequence by IMPACT. And I still think we're the only ones in the country looking for it in prostate patients. So with the exception of that, where I think the immunotherapy could be interesting in terms of profiling, one of the reasons that we would go to exome is that if you could find a set of private neoantigens and sort of combine a vaccine approach with the checkpoint blockade, maybe that would be a reason to sequence everyone by exome. Not necessarily looking for the molecular drivers of their tumor, but looking for private mutations that could be targeted in an immunotherapy approach. So hopefully not too long there, but yep. Way to kick it off. Okay?
Great. Thanks, David. Right, so next up, Zach Cohen from Harvard Medical School.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to preface my comments by saying that in looking for the acceptable responders as I'm about to define them, I think it's important to really focus on the amazing work we've done so far. Because this very sometimes incremental work that we just heard about in ovarian cancer over decades has changed what we can tell our patients. And to stop doing that would be a huge mistake. And I say this from my perspective as both trained as a pediatric endocrinologist and a PhD in computer science. And I'm so I'm going to tell you about my perspective on this, having looked at a lot of different disease areas and also having witnessed amazing miracles. And this is the miracles I want to talk about, which is a patient that has a sarcoma that appears untreatable. You give them a checkpoint inhibitor, and it goes away for years. That's the kind of acceptable responders I think we'd love all to see. And it's a bit of a high watermark, but how do we get there? And I'll try to sort of slowly spiral in with my time limit. In fact, could someone give me a 5-minute warning? Thank you.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Spiral in with my time limit to how at least I think about it. First of all, as someone who was on the Precision Medicine National Academy Science Committee that actually wrote the Precision Report, let me tell you that I deeply believe that there are very few things that are actually genuinely common diseases. Most things that we think are common diagnoses are not, in fact, diagnoses. They are labels for symptoms underlying a lot of pathogenic different causes. Just here in New York, one of my academic grandchildren, the student of one of my former students, so this is Joel Dudley, who was a student of Atul Buttes, one of my students, did this very nice paper last year where they looked at type 2 diabetes. And all they looked at was the clustering of their symptomatology. And they found one group that looked a lot like the way we think of diabetes with vascular complications, and microvascular complications, eye complications, kidney complications. Another group, cardiovascular disease, and cardiovascular disease and a lot of cancer. And yet a third group that looked like it had a more of an immunological picture. And when they did the genomic profiling of these three different groups, they were distinct. And so now, speaking as a pediatric endocrinologist, we don't think of diabetes as three different diseases, but it seems that they are. And if we're going to keep on pulling them in into trials as if they're one group, we're always going to be relatively underpowered because we're treating multiple diseases with the same treatment. And so we have to really be on the lookout for the exceptions that inform us. It's not the greatest commercial success, but I think the taking advantage of the CCR5 success in identifying a protein that without which a mutant you don't have HIV entering your cell really did result in new drugs that prevent HIV from infecting cells. We see natural experiments such as the PCSK9 inhibitors, which take advantage of natural experiments where individuals with these mutants had unnaturally low cholesterol profiles and low heart diseases. Can we find such individuals? Not to treat them specifically, but so that we can understand enough biology to be able to treat those natural experiments without having to go to a mouse, because we know that history of mouse biology is not the best always. Can we use these human natural experiments to go straight to goal? And I'm thinking, for example, of Wagle, a researcher at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, who actually found a bladder cancer patient who responded to mTOR inhibitors amazingly well over a year in a very dire situation, ended up having two mutations in mTOR pathway so that he was mTOR dependent. But I think there's only so far we're going to be able to go with mutations. I think that, as you just heard, the instability is 1.5%, you said?
The MSI?
Yeah.
That's a signature, yeah.
It's a signature, 1.5%. So is that going to account for all the acceptable responders? I don't think so. So what else could we be looking at? Well, the temptation is to say, let's go straight always to the genome, because in fact, now thinking as a computer scientist, that's where our whole program is. But we actually do get reprogrammed several times. By what? By our environment. And specifically, the thing that gets reprogrammed a lot is our immune system. And so what is it about the immune system of these individuals that is changing the way they respond to checkpoint inhibitors, for example? And how do we understand that? And so I'd like to take a quick lateral move into a system that the NIH sponsored, which I happen to be the PI of the coordinating center of, which I think might give us a model. So this is called the Undiagnosed Disease Network. Now, the undiagnosed patients are the exact mirror image of our exceptional responders. They're diagnosed with everyday diagnoses, but they don't respond to any therapy, and clearly they're not who we think they are. And so these are individuals, for example, who have bullous lesions on their skin, who go on to have what looks like third-degree burns throughout their body, and responding to nothing. And so the NIH created a national network, the Undiagnosed Disease Network. based on a very successful program, the UDP, Undiagnosed Disease Network, based on the UDP Undiagnosed Disease Program out of NIH. And in this political era, it's worth saying that this was towards the end of the second term of the Obama presidency. Because of the early success of this program in Washington, there was full bipartisan support to blow this up to a $250 million program that includes 7 large academic health centers nationwide. And what was the focus? The focus was, A, and this is what we proposed in our coordinating center proposal, all the data for all sites would be shared in the cloud, which at the time seemed like a risky place, but it's actually much less risky, as we now know, than your individual healthcare centers. Second of all, we said there's no intellectual property stickiness. No patient is yours. We're going to refer every patient to the right patient, the expert in that area, nationwide. We're certainly going to do whole genome sequencing on them, and all that data is going to go with them in the cloud to whichever all permitted investigators. But we didn't stop there because we realized there was only so far we were going to get with mutations. Because sometimes, in fact, always, you get lots of mutations. It's never clear what's a passenger mutation and what's a causative mutation. So then you have to do expression profiling, and so there's an expression core. You need to be able to look at the metabolomic profile. So we created a metabolomic core. We had said, in an organism, does this cause a mutation? So we have a CRISPR, 2 CRISPR cores, where in flies and zebrafish, we knock in the mutations into that the human has into those organisms. See, does it cause any difference? And we put this data package all together that stays with the patient throughout the network and gets ultimately released. And so really it's a multimodal approach where there's no intellectual property stickiness, where patients can go wherever they want, where data is shared freely, and we recognize that no single data modality is going to be sufficient. So I would posit that what is required here, given the fact that we don't know in advance where the insight's going to come from, that we have to have a means of systematically drawing together all these data. But as we've seen even with patient advocacy organization, everybody, once they have the data, all of a sudden thinks it's theirs and are not great sharers. And so we have to create governance, which basically says it's not the Roach Motel. When the data comes in, it should be able to go out just as easily to be shared with others. And I think, basically, if I was a funder, I would not fund any organization that did not have that set from day one. Otherwise, you're a loser. I just want to now quickly end by actually saying something positive about that $30,000 prize. I have nothing to do with it, but I think it's a great idea. Here's why. So about a year and a half ago, I had a discussion with Jeff Drazen, editor of New England Journal. I said, Jeff, you really got a lot of us data scientists pretty mad because you called us in an editorial. You referred to us types as research parasites. And we don't like it. And there was a huge Twitter storm about it. And Marshall McNutt, who's then senior editor of Science, actually wrote an editorial about it. And I said, what you need to do is create a conference with a contest. And in the end, we did it. And the contest just ended, announced yesterday. So what did we do? We took the SPRINT trial. This is a hypertensive treatment trial. New England Journal published a year ago. Data had not been made public yet. We made the data public to the contestants. And 143 teams internationally competed for this competition. Very small dollar amount, huge prestige. But also, I should tell you, the research parasites love competitions. And so what happened was we learned new things. Like, for instance, if you have any hint of decreased glomerular filtration, any hint of kidney disease, it's not worth it being in the intensive therapy arm, even though the overall component. And there's several other such findings. And it's having lots of eyeballs, not just having a few cancer experts. There are a lot of smart people out there in the world. And making them look at it from a variety of perspectives will give us tools and perspectives that I don't think we'll have otherwise.
So I'll close there and hand it off to someone who really knows how to run big things, Eric Baraxlis.
Thanks. I'm also short, so this is all good. I'm good with this. So thanks. So little bit of a different take. I'm Eric. I'm a parasite. And I'm an industry and only part time. So yeah, you can just keep going. So I want to talk a little bit. Hopefully, try to tie some themes together. So I'm a data science guy, and so what that means at Takeda R&D is that means we've got about 150 data scientists from across all types of domains. I've got 100 biostatisticians. Epidemiologists, informaticists, geneticists, you know, you name it, we kind of do it. And what we've done at Takeda is basically it's real easy, all the data's mine. If data comes into that company, we try to find the way to make it work and make it useful. And I had the honor of helping Zach design and build the Undiagnosed Disease Network. And, you know, what was interesting about that is, you know, Zach kind of said that it's the same, right? You've got these really rare disease patients, undiagnosable, often horrid phenotypes. A lot of these kids don't live very long. It's 80% pediatrics. And the difference with the exceptional responders is statistically they're kind of the same number-wise, but one group's a lot luckier than the other group, right? And so you're looking at that. And then you think about things like the work that's been done on drug resilience. You think about things like the superheroes papers. And you realize that, you know, we as humans respond differentially to different therapies and things. And, you know, things we heard this morning about lifestyle, autophagy, senescence, indolence, all of these things go into this. I'm getting younger because I just keep running, and that's what I hope happens. I'm just going to get younger. I want more mitochondria, right? But then when we look at how we study these, you know, so I'm an FDA alum. I'm not going to pick on the FDA because I'm very proud of the time there and working with them. And I say, you know, my 100 biostatisticians still like me, I think. But I'll sit there and I'll say, you know, we kind of, in registration and randomized clinical trials, we kind of do statistics using math models that were developed when the only tool we had was a slide rule. And we haven't actually changed that a lot. You know, so you do, you know, do very common trial design. You know, again, I'm talking about most, for the most part, industry-sponsored registration trials, larger drug trials, very traditional FDA type trials. And, you know, there's just really an opportunity here to say, look, what defies it? Well, exceptional responders defy that. I think the, you know, the immunotherapies and a lot of the targeted therapies defy that. I think that, you know, I don't believe it when I go in a room now and someone says, you need exactly 63.2 patients to see this effect in a population. I know I don't believe that, right? So I think there's a real chance, and I get a chance where we're located in Cambridge. We're across the MIT from the MIT Media Lab, and they've done this. They've got this really cool set of toys. What they did is they took a bunch of webcams, and while somebody's talking, they read the faces of everybody in the audience, and behind the speaker, there's this big yellow smiley face. And it either smiles, depending on what they do, or frowns, looks mad what they do. And every time somebody puts up an equation, it just automatically is the worst thing you can possibly. So I didn't bring any slides. I'm not going to put up any equations on this, right? But I do think this is a little bit about doing the math on how we design things. I think that we have this opportunity to look at these groups of patients differently. And really, from my perspective, we have to address it at industry and at a regulatory level. I'm going to be apocryphal on this one because I've actually only played one full round of golf in my life. But, you know, exceptional responders are rare, as Mike said. And, yeah, you often notice them in trials where the drug failed, right? But you actually get them in almost all the trials. You really do. And, you know, if I walk up on my second round of golf and I smack a hole in one, right? That's luck. That's crazy. And then I play the, you know, then I'm whatever, four digits over par. And then the next time, I still hit a hole and run. If I was teaching myself golf, and I'm on the course every day, and one of those holes I hit a hole in one, I would have to really think about that. And I do think that's a little bit of the situation that we're in industry right now, where we're kind of pressing these things out. Now, we don't have the ability all the time in industry, as Zach and Dr. Solik do, to see these patients coming through every day and have that type of really intimate contact with them. But what was interesting is when I started thinking about this and talking to people at Millennium about Velcade, all the translational scientists I talked to knew their exceptional responders to that drug by first name because those patients have come forward. They have kind of talked about it. The companies do know where they are and where they exist, you know, the 7-year, the 8-year, the prolonged response. So I actually think the social experiment's been done. It's being done every day. In the clinics, as we've already heard about, it can be done by biopharma. The other only other thing I'll say about that now is and Zach made this point, and I don't want to downplay the importance of molecular profiling. It's how I get paid. It's a lot of what we do, and it's really important. But one of the most fascinating things, to go back to rare diseases for a second, is when I took my first big pharma job in the late 90s, no pharma did this. You couldn't even do it. And then at FDA, I watched the way the orphan desk, medical products, women's health, minority health, rare disease desks are up, you know, in a different part, sitting there, really, really struggling to learn from what's coming on in these trials, you know. And so when I look at that and I realize that that's not true now, every major pharma has a rare disease programs now. Why? Because they've realized that they can find biological insight by putting the edges of the puzzle together first, like we all do, that then will help them, translate to larger populations, right? So I would say that it is important to do this study. We should actually be thinking differently. We should have these cohorts identified in our bio statistical plan when we write NDAs and INDs. Identify them, have them up there, work on it, know it, use it. The last thing I'll say before we go back and try to have a good conversation here about a lot of this is that one of the important things about the Undiagnosed Disease Network and what the Undiagnosed Disease Program at NIH showed long before Zach and I got involved with it was the importance of deep phenotyping these patients. You know, you can get a lot of molecular observations when you do a lot of molecular profiling. Of course you do. But how many physical traits can you actually attach any of that to? How do you associate outcomes? You know, I mean, I actually am 3 weeks out of my last round of cancer therapy for renal cancer. I'm doing fine. It's not about me. It's all good. I have one really crazy ass mutation that came out of my snapshot. You know, so what I see when we see this is that, yeah, people have mutations, but, you know, if 1.5% of the population or 10%, what about the 90% that don't have it? How do we give David Sawat, all these folks, better tools to treat the larger populations? And I would argue that if we rethink how we're doing the math, we will find a way to do it. Thank you.
So maybe we'll start with the deep phenotyping. David, you actually said, I forget what percentage of the patients that you sequenced that you didn't find an apparent driver of the exceptional response. And so, you know, maybe you can start and then we can kind of go around the panel, but what other attributes or parts of the cancer patient phenotype is contributing to the exceptional response if it's not a activated pathway or something like that? Or is it just that we haven't identified the activated pathway and it is all about the pathway, Adam?
Yeah, there's at least 10% of the patients that we sequence that we find absolutely nothing. There's also a group of patients where we sequence and we find somatic mutations like that melanoma case, but we don't know if they're important. And I think it's evolving into a big data exercise where what's going to be important is data sharing, but also better clinical annotation, like you mentioned. But we're finding that if we look at these cases hard enough, we can solve them all. I mean, a recent case was a pediatric sarcoma. You know, run through the assay, we don't find anything. We reflex eventually the whole genome. We find a novel translocation that's never been described, and this was something that was clinically labeled as Ewing's-like. And actually, the term was not incorrect because it was like Ewing's a little bit, but it didn't have the right translocation. It had different translocation. It was really a completely different disease that no one's really described. And to me, you can't develop rational treatments if you don't even know the underlying cause of the disease. And so just one of the things we need to do is catalog all those causes. And I think we're going to be done with that exercise in the next 5 to 7 years, that the technology is moving fast enough that we can solve all these pathogenic issues in the next few years in cancer. And then it just will default back to, well, what are you going to do with that information? And we still have a lot of mutations that are drivers that we can't target at this point, KRAS probably being a prototypical example.
Mm-hmm. So what other attributes are you contributing as well?
I'm going to let Eric talk about some of the sort of personal, broader, holistic components, which I think are hugely important, but I can't speak as well about them. So instead, I'll talk about something which I still believe we do poorly, just because it's early days in the science. There is a whole systems biology of K chemokines and the immune system that we don't understand well. And our current ways of assessing, let's say, superantigens is still very primitive compared to what could be done if we had an accurate parallel assessment of the state of the both innate and adaptive immune system. And so I think pushing the profiling of the immune system both at the system level and at the local level is going to be very, very helpful in, I think, at least a big subclass of these patients. And I don't see it being done broadly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, so on the phenotyping, it's anything and everything, but it's getting much more ordered, right? I mean, with the UDN, worked with the folks that have done the human phenome ontology, say that right. And, you know, this is, you know, you think about doing physicals and think about examining patients and, you know, how much time you have and stuff like that. You know, these are groups that have come up with, I don't even know how many ways to describe nostril shape in a rare disease patient, right? So there's actually ways to really think about doing this. Feature analysis, pathology, you know, there's lots of, we keep getting better at measuring stuff. And I'm an engineer, so I, you know, that's important to me. But I'm not convinced that all the stuff we can measure is relevant. Just because you can measure something doesn't mean it's relevant. So I think it takes a lot of clinician and judgment. And one of the things that happens with the UDN is that a basic scientist as well as clinicians are assigned to the cases. They also sequence pedigrees. They also look at family members. They look at other things. And, you know, it's both investigational, but it's also for very real things like fertility counseling and everything like that that goes on that's also very important. So I think our ability to measure something is getting much better. I think the other thing I would say is that one of the things we're doing a lot of now, and we're not doing in this space, we're doing in all spaces, are things like passive phenotyping. And I don't like the word digital. I was a hospital engineer in the 80s, and I just think a lot of companies have rebranded whatever tech they had last year as digital. But what I do know is we start every clinical trial with at least one, probably two wearables, patches, multiple devices, trying to find out how these patients are doing 24/7. You know, can we actually determine that for patients that are sleeping better, and if we can measure that objectively, are they in less pain? You know, because that's pretty important, right? Do people stay on therapies? All of these other things are there. So I think passive phenotyping and some of these things are now. They're not tomorrow. I'm actually speaking at the National Academies tomorrow on this. And I think they're actually really exciting to bring some of those things in, because I think we can get more patient-centric about this. I know that the care team that I get to deal with every day, I'm very different from them. I have clinically, I get to see Michael Blute, who's a renal lung chair at MGH, so I'm very fortunate to get to do that. You know, he's talked to me about other patients that are like me. They are all over 70 African-American, have BMIs like 30.
Just like you.
Just like me. So, you know, so kind of looking at what it is. So I'm not the phenotype. So should I be on the same surveillance protocol as those guys? It's the best he has, right? It's the closest he has. So you draw a line, and you got to realize that just putting everybody on the line may not make the most sense.
So I haven't been involved in the rare cancer, the rare disease initiative, and it may be different than what's going on in cancer. And you sort of hinted at this data ownership issue, but you know, I've come to the conclusion that actually the doctors are the problem for rare diseases because they don't like to work together and they don't collaborate well. So we've really just taken an opposite approach to really try to bypass all the doctors. And this is being done at Harvard as well, at the Broad, in an initiative called Count Me In. And so, you know, it's 2017, and we have this thing called the Internet. And we don't really need the doctors to refer the patients anymore. We can go right to the patients. And what I've found is that with a rare cancer like my daughter's, so for her cancer, we only see 4 patients a year on average at Sloan Kettering, and we're the major referral center with that type of cancer. And so if we were going to stick to the paradigm of waiting for enough people to come in to Sloan Kettering to collect enough tumors to actually do this analysis, it would take, you know, many, many years, and we'd never get it done. On the flip side, when she was first diagnosed, I did what everyone else does, which is I went to the people at MD Anderson, at Dana-Farber and others, and I said, you know, we want to collaborate on this, and, you know, would you send the tumors? It's not a money issue. We can easily raise the money to do this. And everyone said the right thing, which is, yeah, we'd love to collaborate, but when you get down to it, nobody ever sent us anything. We never got a single tumor. But what really happened is that within, like, 12 hours of trying, my wife had made friends with every single mom of a kid with an ovarian germ cell tumor in, like, the entire world. And these people will self-aggregate on the internet. And there really is no reason to have the doctors refer these patients. You can just bypass the doctors completely and have potentially every patient with that condition send you their material centrally, analyze it in a central way, and directly interact with the patients and not with the doctors. And so that's completely my strategy. I think this can be applied to more common things as well. I mean, what Nick Wagley is doing up at the Broad is, for example, saying, related to extraordinary responders, anyone who's had nivolumab treatment and has breast cancer and has had a complete response, send us your tumor, and we'll analyze it and put it in this joint cohort. And forget about the doctors. Getting their permission and the IRB stuff, it's just impossible. Just consent the patients directly. And I think that's really going to change the way we do all the rare cancers, but even common cancers, but then rare phenotypes within those cancers. I think we can go right to people. Right.
I think that's very insightful, and I think that's broadly correct. The fly in the ointment, I mean, this is something that I've been dealing with for 20 years now, 30 years, is that the healthcare systems, if you don't do it right, make it very inefficient, effortful, and sometimes impossible to get the data that they have about you, the patient, out. It's doable, but it takes enormous activation energy, like your wife, to make things happen. And not everybody has your wife's energy. And, you know, I was really impressed. In fact, this is informed the way we work in the UDN. There's a man by the name of Matt Might, who was featured in the New Yorker article called One of a Kind about 3 years ago. And his kid was diagnosed, had seizures, hypotonia, lack of development. His kid was the first to be diagnosed, first human being to be diagnosed with a mutation in a glycosylation enzyme, NGLY1. And he was the first. So he didn't wait for doctors to create the cohort. What he did is he reached out through Facebook to Twitter to Google AdWords, and within 2 years had 50 patients who not only had the same symptoms but had mutations in the same gene. Yeah. And so that's, I think, very important, and we have to do that. And in the UDN, we tweet out routinely, have you seen a patient with this, this, and this, or are you a patient with this symptoms? But I can tell you firsthand that even when you have the data, even when you have a full right to the data, getting that data out of the healthcare system is very problematic. And what I'm about to describe is a solution, but not the full solution. So we're leading a project that's part of all of us called Sync for Science, where the NIH and the Office of the National Coordinator are paying it for the moment, which is to get, and we've met with all seven of the major electronic health record vendors so that if the patient just signs up on a portal, all the data gets dumped out. So far, the vendors have been great, surprisingly great. We'll see how well the healthcare systems themselves are in implementing that software on their EHRs. But I think you're absolutely right, David. That's the lever that we have. And we've seen an undiagnosed disease network. It's the most powerful lever. And I'm also reminded when Eric talks about how he's seen regulation affect and drive science. We've seen similar things in the undiagnosed disease network. For instance, Matt Might, his wife in Utah, drove through right-to-try legislation. And doctors don't like right-to-try legislation. But if you're a parent, sometimes it seems like there's not very many things worse than the death of your child, so maybe it's worth trying. So we're going to be, I think, pushing the envelope on all sorts of conventional wisdom, not only about how you get cohorts, but what is the right ethical framework.
Mm-hmm. Some questions out there.
Yeah. Good. Reality check. I think at Memorial and Dana-Farber, every patient who comes in is getting genotyped, if not, you know, foundation, if not full genome. And I know when Vice President Biden kicked off the moonshot, and I'm sorry Greg Simon isn't here with us, that was a vision, is that every patient everywhere with cancer would walk in the door and get typed, and they'd be put in touch with it without having extra ordinary resources available. They'd be placed into a trial or treated appropriately for whatever that genotyping and phenotyping might show. But in reality, right now in 2017, in most, is it being done in most cancer centers? Is it anywhere close to being done in community centers?
I mean, it depends upon the cancer type. There are certain cancer types that you can bill for some degree of genetic testing. And, you know, if you send your tumor to Foundation Medicine and you've got lung cancer, or colon cancer, or melanoma, it's going to get done. And Foundation does a very good job of looking for all the druggable things in large part. They're missing some things, and they don't get signatures well, and they don't do the germline. But they're, you know, for certain cancers, you can do it. For other tumors, there's no evidence one way or another whether it's helpful, and Medicare is a pretty just strict, we won't pay for it, you know, and Medicare really hasn't even started paying for melanoma and lung cancer well at this point. So it depends upon your insurance. It depends upon what hospital you go to. You know, at Memorial, we fill in the gaps by doing it for free if it's not billable, and we take a pretty conservative view. But cancers like breast cancer, it's still not, at least in our mind, considered standard of care to do genomic testing with next-gen sequencing. I mean, we look for molecular things like HER2 amplification by FISH, but we don't do necessarily next-gen as standard of care. So we do it for free. And we've already committed over $2 million of free genomic testing for women with breast cancer. And so it does depend upon where you go. But I think what frustrates me the most is that there are patients who get the genetic testing and they've got a disease where we're really looking for an alteration in their disease, but the test that they got was inadequate. But once you've had one test, you can't necessarily bill again for a second test that's a little bit better. And so that's really the dilemma at this point. I think the other thing that's really impeding progress relates to Wall Street, and there's probably a lot of Wall Street people in the audience today, but you know, there's a degree of confidentiality around new drugs. You know, oh, we've seen a response on this phase one study, but I can't talk about it because it's not public, and that could affect the stock of the company. But that actually slows down enrollment for the right patients. And if we could use social media now to say, well, we just had, you know, we've had 8 patients with, you know, mutation X go on the study, and 6 of them have responded, we would probably much more quickly enroll that cohort. That either disease-specific cohort or genotype-specific cohort, but we're almost not allowed to talk about that data for a year or 2 years until it gets presented at some national meeting like ASCO. So I think if there was some sort of indemnity to me that I'm not going to jail for some SEC violation, and I could talk about all the really exciting things we've seen over the last year, people would be shocked. We've seen some really exciting things, but I can't really talk at them so easily at a meeting like this. I can talk about them more easily when I go give grand rounds at University of Chicago or something. But here, you know, I know there's a lot of people here in the audience who might take that information and use it in a financial way. And if we could somehow get over that hurdle, I think we could, you know, really move progress forward much quicker.
There's also a flip side to this, which is I think what David said is really the right way. But at the same time, we have to avoid believing our own hype. Just looking over my shoulder here, to a recently published article in JAMA Oncology, December 2016, out of Gary Aliman's group out of University of Washington. 9 patients with a variety of cancers each patient got 2 of the commercially available mutation screening tests, one Foundation One and the other from Guardant. And here's the thing. So this is what we're paying thousands of dollars for to insurance. I'm going to tell you the stats. You tell me if you're an insurer you want to pay for this. These two tests, A, disagreed on a whole bunch of mutations across all these patients and only agreed on about 100 mutations out of 45. For half the patients, they disagreed completely on which drugs were the right drugs to use given the mutations. Whether you're an insurer or a patient, think about what the state of the art that represents. And so I think what it tells us is that the translation, either we have the knowledge and we're not translating it effectively to our commercial platforms, or our knowledge is yet insufficient. And so that tells me that the most responsible thing to do is to do what Sloan Kettering is doing, which is amassing these data and developing their own judgments based on all these data But the nice thing to happen would have to have a much broader sort of data sharing in that respect.
Mm-hmm. So that's an important point. I mean, how long do you think it'll be until, you know, this data is mature enough and useful enough and predictable enough to make broadly, you know, not just in Sloan Kettering, but across other centers?
The problem is we only have 7 minutes and 49, 48, 47 seconds. I mean, this is like a three-hour conversation as to the flaws with the Garden test and the foundation test and interpretation. And it's very disease-specific. I mean, if there is a patient who comes in with lung cancer and you get the Garden test and they don't find a canonical MAP kinase RTK driver, something is being missed, okay? And I don't know what that is. And it could be that when the test was drawn that the tumor wasn't shedding enough DNA into the blood because that's a cell-free DNA test. But if you understand the disease well enough, then you would be able to interpret that result correctly. The problem is that most of the medical oncologists in the world don't understand this topic well enough because they didn't learn it in medical school, and it's really complicated. So this is actually going to be a great use, and I actually had a group of young people tour my lab yesterday. But this is going to be and one of them asked me a question about artificial intelligence, which I had at least 3 seconds think about how am I going to answer this question. And I turned the question about artificial intelligence into a physician support tool, okay? So what we do need is we need physician support tools to tell the doctors how to interpret this information because they don't understand it. And nobody can know what all these mutations mean. I mean, there's millions of potential mutations in these tumors. Nobody can have memorized all that. And this is a perfect job for computers. And so the point of the physician support tool is to make sure that the physician doesn't screw up, okay, which is the case. So if they're – and I get these emails from the Sloan Kettering doctors every day, and they're misinterpreting the data, which is if the patient didn't have a RET-ROS fusion, an ALK fusion, a BRAF V600E, an EGFR mutation, a KRAS mutation – that the case is not solved, that we don't know what's making that tumor grow, and we don't know what the right drug is. And there's two possible reasons that they don't have one of those. One is that the test failed to detect it, and they have one of those. Or two, they've got something else that's making their tumor grow, like an NTRK fusion that could also be drugged. But the test was not designed to detect that specific fusion. And that's a level of sophistication that's beyond just having the test available. And it's sort of an educational thing that we'll need to get out to the community. And the reason it's not going to happen right away is that as much as it might be great to find for every case what the driver is, if you are being seen in North Dakota and you have no access to the NTRK inhibitor anyway, how hard really should we be looking for it? So if the patient will never go on a clinical trial related to that, maybe all they really need is EGFR and ALK testing because they're never going to get the other drugs anyway. So eventually, you know, there'll be places like Sloan Kettering that are pushing the field forward, and then those things will become standard of care. But what I see, which is unfortunate right now, is a lot of inequality in the system, that there are people who are fortunate that they can make sure their cancer is, you know, tumors paid for by Foundation Medicine to test it, or they just happen to be lucky and live around the corner from Sloan Kettering, even though they're an indigent patient on Medicare. But so it's just there's a lot of inequality and luck in the system right now. And that's just what happens on the cutting edge of something that's changing very quickly. And eventually, you know, this technology will move out to everyone. And I don't think it's that far away. I think we're at a watershed moment. And so everyone expects that the FDA is going to approve nivolumab or one of the checkpoint blockade inhibitors as a pan-cancer treatment in anyone who's got microsatellite instability. And if that happens, then at least in my opinion, every cancer becomes billable. Because in every cancer we've looked at, pretty much, there's some low incidence of microsatellite instability. So now there's a reason to look for that in every tumor type. And so if that happens as expected in the next month, then everything is billable, which then would still take a year or two to negotiate that with insurance companies. Everyone will get some level of testing. It just may not be good enough for everyone. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Brian?
Yeah. I live in South Dakota, and we do have the trial for the TRK fusion. We have the LOXO 101. I think this is moving far more quickly than anyone thinks. So I agree with your concerns over disparities between Foundation and Guardant. We've only run probably about 300 We've run 700 in total, and of the 300, pretty much on the SNPs, one has concordance. On the amplifications, one has significant discordance. I'll recognize that. But I think David and yourself have made the most solid point, which is that it's all in the interpretation.
Was that a pun?
And you really have to know your signaling pathways and how to put these things together in order to act. But certainly the tests are out there everywhere, including in our whole community. They are being used. They will be used progressively more rapidly. But everything is in the interpretation, which, and you can, you know, if you just take the front page, and forgive me, I am deep colleagues to the Foundation of Medicine, if you just take the front page and you act on that, you will do harm. Mm-hmm.
So last couple minutes, another big topic is just, you know, what are the regulatory implications of what we're learning and from these exceptional responder initiatives? You touched on, David, on MSI-High and you know, how that could define, you know, at least drug reimbursement. I think you described it by the biomarker. But, you know, is it going to change, or are we going to see drugs being resurrected that, you know, now they're going to be defined trials around failed programs, but they're redefined around an exceptional response cohort, I guess? Or are we going to see more labeling based on mutational profile, or, you know?
Yeah, so I think the misinterpretation from our work has been that we believe that everyone with a particular mutation is going to respond similarly if they have different cancers. We've actually, our work shows the complete opposite, but it's misinterpreted in that regard. I mean, if you look at BRAF, which is something we've studied, you know, extensively, you know, the response rate with a BRAF V600E mutation in melanoma is about 60%. It's 100% in a rare cancer called histiocytosis. It's close to 0% in colon cancer, and it's about 45% in lung cancer. So that's with the same exact BRAF V600E. So we believe that disease context matters. The problem is just drug access right now. I mean, I think the insurance companies, not the insurance, the drug companies have put them, they've created this situation by making the drugs so expensive that it's hard to get them. And the watershed moment for this, I still remember in my career. So before Avastin was FDA approved, you could get any drug for any patient just by writing the prescription. It was not that hard. So when Herceptin came out, we were giving Herceptin to everybody who had even like a hint of HER2 overexpression if we didn't have a better option. So sarcoma patients and colon patients, they were all getting Herceptin. And, you know, if they had one plus HER2, and none of them were responding, and within a year we kind of realized that, and people stopped giving it, okay? But when Avastin came out, the Sloan Kettering Pharmacy actually did a calculation that if we gave Avastin to all the patients who wanted it or their doctors wanted it, and then we didn't get reimbursed, we would be bankrupt in like a year. So Sloan Kettering was just going to run out of money in like a year. And so the pharmacy imposed the restriction that either the insurance company was going to agree up front to pay for it, or it was the FDA-approved indication. And then overnight, all of a sudden, there was no drug access to a new FDA-approved drug beyond its FDA-approved indication. And that's really slowed down progress in many ways. Because we couldn't do the trial and error anymore and quickly figure it out. And, you know, if the drugs weren't so expensive, this wouldn't be such a big deal. But Avastin was that expensive, and the newer drugs are even more expensive. So that's the dilemma.
Yeah, I think a couple things. I think absolutely we now know that approval is one thing, value is something else, and it's somehow we have to get to value. The one place I can tell you that I do see this changing every day is compassionate care, because most companies like us, when you have a responder on your trial, you commit and you're obligated to supply drug for that patient as long as you can. And that's I know that's something we've looked at within Takeda from the concept of safety and lots of things for a long time. So I do think there are these cases that just come up that you've got to do. You've got that drug.
You mean on your experimental drugs?
On our experimental drugs, yeah. At any stage. You know, if it's providing benefit, then we're obligated to giving it as long as we reasonably can.
So, Eric, I want to make sure I understand that. So if you have an experimental drug and you have a patient responding to it, Takeda's going to there's some GMP stuff that I don't understand to make it quality care. You're going to have to keep on doing that.
It's an interest as long as they can. I don't know that we've run into that case multiple times in my 18 months there. What I haven't seen happen was a batch run out.
Wow.
I haven't seen what we've stocked out. Right. That would be a really interesting case at that point, because now you're talking a tremendous amount of money.
Patients on 7+ years, and the companies will continue to provide. But the flip side is, if you then have another patient with a MEK1 mutation, I showed you that ovarian case. trying to get the MEK1 mutation patient, the MEK inhibitor, is sometimes impossible. And we do write letters, you know, we ask for it. And so if Medicare, you don't even bother. It's not even worth it. There's actually no one at Medicare to even write the letter to. So there's nobody there. Okay, there's nobody home. And so for those patients, you just go to the company, and sometimes, you know, occasionally you'll get it and sometimes you won't. And it's a bit frustrating. And so that's why we created the basket studies in large part. The point of the basket study was to provide access to anyone with that mutation so that we could actually test the hypothesis that it would work. Now, what if the response rate's 10%? It doesn't mean the original data was wrong. It's just it's only 10%. Maybe we need combinations. Maybe we need better drugs. But what's frustrating as a scientist is seeing that hypothesis go untested, you know, for years. Because the drug is too expensive to get, you know, off label. It's just too can't do it.
Let me ask a naive question. I don't think you have to be a computer scientist or mathematician to know that if the pricing on these drugs were used for all cancer patients, we'd exceed our GDP. So at what point do the prices change?
I'm going to ask the pharmacy guy.
That's what I mean by value. I mean, to just be honest, but I have no idea. You know, I'm a scientist as well. But clearly, this is what people are looking for and saying that we've got a real issue, healthcare-wise, policy-wise, about how these things can be paid for and what the real value of them is. And, you know, you can do, you know, we've got non-inferiority. I mean, you look at the regulatory paradigm, we've got to go at it and change it from the whole perspective.
Okay, I think we're just about out of time, so I really thank the panelists. It was a great, you know, educational talk and a good discussion.
Thank you. Thank you.